Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Sarah Ma. She's a third-generation Canadian-born Chinese woman raised in Vancouver, BC. Her family was among the early Chinese immigrants levied the head tax in the late 1800s, as well as those who left rural China in the 1950s in search of a better life in Canada. Formerly trained in genetics and epidemiology, and now pursuing a PhD, her feminist activism began as a frontline anti-violence worker at a rape crisis center and transition house. And she continues her work as a member of the Asian Women Coalition Ending Prostitution. So first off, thank you for your work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having us.
So let's start by asking, what is the Asian Women Coalition Ending Prostitution?
Right. So we're a Canadian Asian women feminist group. We're based in Vancouver. Our membership includes and has included Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, Korean, and Filipino women. And our membership represents a range of life experiences common to Asian women, including prostituted women, as immigrants, naturalized Canadians, permanent residents, foreign students, and Canadian-born offspring of Asian immigrants. We're also a volunteer group with extensive frontline work experience. Many of our members have provided concrete aid and support to battered and raped women, and including prostituted women. Just a little history about our group. We had decided to organize in 2005 because we realized that Asian women's interests had to be better represented. There was a federal justice subcommittee that was traveling across the country at the time to consult about prostitution. One of their goals was to make some decisions about how to respond to prostitution. And we had seen how hard it was for Aboriginal women to be heard and taken seriously by the committee. And we also saw, though, that prostitution legal reform would have a huge impact on Asian women. But the people pushing for legalization of prostitution didn't look like us or represent us. So that's why we had organized.
So I have three directions possibly to go, and you can choose any one of the three or go all three. The first one is, you said that people who didn't look like you, you were not so represented. That's one part. The other is, what are the special considerations, or what are the special concerns about Asian women in terms of sexual assault, in terms of prostitution, in this dominantly white culture? And the third direction is that you said prostituted women, and there's a commonly used phrase these days in the mainstream press and in the, what do we want to say, pro-prostitution lobby among leftists, of saying sex workers. And prostituted women has a very different feel. Can you go whichever of those directions, or meld all three of those in any way you want?
Well, those are three very loaded questions. I think I'll try and go for the first one first, but I'd like to address all of them.
Yes, please. Yes, please.
So for the first one about those pushing for legalization of prostitution not looking like us or representing us, we decided to organize as Asian women and to work on this issue because we ourselves have a major stake in how society chooses to deal with it. So that's why we look at prostitution as a form of violence against women, more specifically as sexualized racism. And that's why we organized to build awareness about harms of prostitution to women, and particularly to Asian women. As we know, prostitution is a global phenomenon, and many of those who make up the women and girls that are trafficked for prostitution are Asian, and we know that this is that's a trade for which Asian women and girls, and well, racialized women and poor women are particularly vulnerable to. Our focus has mostly been local to Vancouver, but we've also made the connections with women and organizations around the world. So that's on the sort of self-organizing piece to that. What was the second question?
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask that.
Oh, no!
The second question, well, let's go to the... Oh, the second question, what... Oh, shoot. Oh, let's go to the third question.
Okay, so the third question was about referring to prostitution as sex work, right?
Right.
So why do we not see prostitution as a form of work? Well, I mean, prostitution, you know, if you take into account what the industry is based on, it's based on capitalism, and treating women's bodies as a commodity, and it makes no sense as a form of employment or work when it's bodily integrity that's undermined and violated. And really, under any employment standard in any country, would not be compatible with standards against sexual assault and harassment, because that's the job. The job is, the so-called job would be to be sexually assaulted and harassed. Moreover, I think a lot of people try and talk about unionizing the sex industry, but the problem with that is that the people control the industry are men and pimps, and they have no interest in women's safety or economic independence or dignity. So I would say it's much more consistent with a form of violence against women, because you're taking advantage of women's economic insecurity, and you're using that to recruit them, women and girls, to a trade that is based on sexual inequality between men and women, and I would say completely undermines women's consent.
You know, there's a one of the founding documents of queer theory is by Gail Rubin, and in there she talks about how people having various sexual fetishes would be the, which she includes pedophilia, would be no different than having a taste for spicy food. It's just different tastes. And in an analysis I've done that isn't published yet, I responded to that, you know, that's very interesting, but I've never heard of anybody having to get years of therapy for PTSD for eating hot and sour soup. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things it says on your on the group's website is between 80 and 95% of persons in prostitution have suffered some form of violence before entering the system. That's rape, incest, pedophilia. And 68% of women in prostitution meet the criteria for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. That's in the same range as victims of torture undergoing treatment. And so can you talk, I mean, I am embarrassed to have to ask this, but there are those, a fair number of people who, including some people in power, who compare being prostituted to working at Walmart. And I think you and I both agree that capitalism is exploitative, but there is something beyond, for prostitution, there is something beyond the degradation of simply having to get a wage job. Can you speak to the specific harms of prostitution? Like I said, I'm embarrassed to even have to ask this, because the question just seems so self-evident. You know, I would not want to be on the street and have to, I mean, literally walking down the street in the town where I live and have to give a blowjob to someone who walks up to me and said, and gives me money. There's a fundamental difference between that and other jobs. And it's embarrassing. Our discourse is so crappy that I feel like I have to ask this ridiculous question.
Well, I mean, I would say also that, I mean, there's not a lot different between prostitution and rape. I mean, you're basically undermining, instead of simply not getting consent. I think you're avoiding consent through the mechanism of money to gain sexual access to a woman or a girl. This has been seen in in war times and in the military. I think it's been documented by many people, but even Susan Brown Miller talks about it in Against Our Will in her book. And many of the soldiers were instructed to either rape or to offer money. Because these two things were sufficient to sexually conquer women, and particularly, for imperialist nations to conquer their countries that they were trying to colonize and that they were trying to gain control over.
So that really leads to the next question is, can you talk about the relationship between prostitution and colonialism?
Right. So we talked a lot this year about the connection between prostitution and actually prostitution as a tool of imperialism and colonialism. One of the keys to success of the imperialists or the colonialists is to keep a country in a state of flux, teetering in the abundance of needs, never having full control over their economy or their resources. And what that does is it gives the invading or the imperialist country an excuse to occupy, an excuse to invade. And then on top of that, you have the capitalist system that ensures that the distribution of the wealth is going to be unequal, both among countries, but also among people, among women. So, we have, for example, the reality of the feminization of poverty. And as part of this system, you have the exploitation of workers for cheap labor and goods. You have foreign debt. And so I think all of that, works into, that kind of works itself into the unequal, the imbalance between men and women. So you have men and women within a nation and then between nations. And we know that prostitution has been used as an accessory for military occupation. We know that in every resource extraction, we know that a lot of women are often in the countries that are invaded are often used as the spoils of war. The violence against women in the country that you're invading, women are very closely connected to the culture of that country and to the stability, to the labor force and the economy. They're very key to that. And so when an invading force uses prostitution, rape, as a sexual conquest, it's also racialized, and what you're doing is you're sexualizing that racism. For example, we know that rape is a strategy of the military to control opposing ethnic groups and communities and dehumanize the host country as the inferior class. So you're tapping into that sexual inequality that already exists between men and women, and you're racializing it, and this has sort of been the history of sexual racism. There's a legal scholar, her name is Sunny Won, and she calls it white sexual imperialism, and she uses that term to describe the social inequality between white men and racialized women who come from a culture historically colonized by the West. And really, it's sexual conquest that has served all aspects and tactics of imperialism and colonialism, but particularly those of the military. And now what we're seeing more recently, resource extraction, we know about prostitution, feeding into mining companies, being set up near pipelines. There's a number of connections.
So what do the imperialists, have you read Lundy Bancroft's Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men?
No.
Yeah, he has a really interesting thing in there about domestic violence. And he says that the question to ask a lot of times is, he thinks that abusers don't actually lose control. That's what we think. They lose control because they got so mad. And then he asks, when they lose control, do they beat up a cop? Not usually. Of course, the violence still goes down the hierarchy. And likewise, if they destroy things, do they destroy their own stereo? No, they're not actually out of control. And the reason I bring all this up is because the question to ask is, what does the abuser gain tangibly out of that outburst? And so the question I have is, what do the imperialists gain tangibly out of these acts of the sexualization of violence? If Japan invades China, or if Germany invades Russia, or if the United States colonizes the world, or if the British colonize China, what does the empire gain out of that sexualized resource extraction of the women in the colonized country? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly some parallels between, you know, women and the environmental exploitation and resource extraction. But, you know, at the same time, they're different. And I mean, because, you know, these are, you know, women I would say it's dangerous to apply sort of a feminization of the environment. It's not quite the same. I think the attack, the relationship between men and women and between people and the environment, obviously the relationship between men and women, it's hierarchical, but it's a sexualized hierarchy that's distinct from the environment and sort of to inherently masculinize the, you know, people and to feminize the environment is a little bit, you know, it's misleading, right? But in terms of how conquering women in a host country, what that has to do with imperialism, I think it's really key to taking, and plays into taking over a country's natural resources and their property, by exploiting women in that country, by exploiting the people's labor, by keeping the people poor in those countries. What we find, it's very much part of the conquest of places such as Vietnam and such as Thailand. You know, for instance, the military is responsible for the persistence of red light districts in Thailand, and a lot of which has. Are now very key to Thailand's economy, and I think it completely threw off their economic system, and it's also part of setting up that the violence and both the racialized and the sexualized violence in those host countries. And that's all part of that all plays into the rise of global trade, and sort of the imperialist and the colonialist nations to secure the natural resources in the country now. Does that sort of answer?
Well, yeah, it's a fabulous answer, and thank you for that. And I think my question was just kind of muddled, and the question I was trying to get at is that. Mm-hmm. So I was just doing a talk a couple days ago, and before the talk, the night before, I took a walk. It was late at night when I got in, and then I took a walk to a restaurant that was still open, and then I walked back on deserted streets. And as a man, I can do that. And at talks, I've asked about that, that, you know, as a woman, if you got into some unknown city at 1 o'clock in the morning, and then you could do, you know, a long walk through deserted streets to a restaurant, would you do it? And of course, a lot of women say no. And so I'm looking at rape as an act of political terror and how that affects women and inhibits their behavior. And then I'm wondering how, or inhibits their freedom. And so I'm wondering about what the sexualized violence against women does to an entire people. That's what I was really trying to get at. I'm sorry I wasn't clear. Do you see what I'm trying to get at now?
And what that has to do with imperialism or?
Yeah, and how, I mean, if rape is a pretty constant tool of the military, which we can agree it is, so what did the U.S. military, what did the U.S. gain by putting in those red light districts? How did the, why is that a consistent tool of imperialism? And I'm not talking about, you know, making it easier to extract the resources. I'm trying, why do they do it? That's the point.
Well, I mean, I do think that it has to do with establishing that hierarchy in the host country. But I mean, we know that, we know that the military and military bases, occupation, economic trade agreements, resource extraction, they're all part of how governments occupy and exploit people in other countries. And rape and prostitution is used to support all of these endeavors, but it's also in its own right used as a strategy to conquer and control those opposing ethnic groups and communities, and upholds patriarchy in those countries, and infuses that with racialized or sexualized racism as well. So, I mean, for instance, we have the military base in Okinawa, and that's plagued people there with the noise and the constant threat of harassment and violence to the women there. Over in the springtime, we saw the murder of a 20-year-old Okinawan woman by a 34-year-old white U.S. military base worker. The communities there live with that constant threat of male violence that is also, it's also racialized.
So I think the second question, when I asked those three questions early on, the second question I think was, what are some of the unique challenges faced by Asian women within a predominantly a white supremacist culture? And I'm thinking about this, especially the sexualized violence. And there are everything from in pornography, you know, sort of Asian women sites, to Asian brides, to even quite often in how Asian women are presented in more mainstream films. Can you talk about what you mean, especially by sexualized racism?
Right. So, I mean, I think giving the context of imperialism and colonialism sort of gives us that base for understanding where sexualized racism for Asian women in prostitution is rooted in history. You know, what is that? Where does the myth of the hypersexualized Asian woman come from? Where does geisha doll, where does the Asian subservience, where does China doll come from? Right. We see both the racist stereotypes used to market Asian women all over the place. I mean, from adult advertising, in mainstream media, in pornography, and in pop culture. And, you know, it's very much related to the history and migration of Asian peoples, and that historical social inequality between the white man and the woman of the Orient. So the, you know, a lot of these stereotypes, China doll, fresh off the boat, geisha girl, these still continue to be used, and they're very much part of male demand in prostitution, and you know, even and are used to shape men's expectations, not just of Asian women in prostitution, but Asian women as a group. And so what you have are massage parlors, a huge result of Asian immigration of Asian people, throughout the last century and a half, I would say, a lot of these Asian massage parlors that have been set up, you know, across most major cities in North America. And you can see the prevalence, the advertising is persistent. And they do target Asian women in particular. And most municipalities have really failed to challenge the operation of these prostitution businesses. And instead, they've really worked to normalize male entitlement to women's bodies, and particularly Asian women. But and these are also sites for, of course, trafficking in Asian women. But the stereotypes aren't just harmful to Asian women in prostitution, but to all Asian women. I mean, one of the consequences that we all get to live with, the myth of the man who suffers from yellow fever, the one who believes all of the racist fantasies of Asian women being dragon lady, or the Asian woman being, you know, the subservient China doll, the man who suffers from yellow fever. I mean, it's not just your John. It's your husband. It's your boyfriend. It's your coworker or your boss or your peer. So that's kind of how pervasive the sexualized racism is. That it's just more obvious in prostitution, but I think it really pervades society and our lives.
And so you've talked about this, but can you be more explicit about some of the challenges specifically to the challenges that Asian women would face more than, for example, a white woman in this white society? You've gone there, but can you take that further even?
Yeah, and I think it has very much to do with, one of the reasons, one of the factors that make Asian women in particular vulnerable to human trafficking. But at least in the context of North America, anyways, even in the global context, I think women and girls coming from Asia are often incredibly impoverished. When they get to North America, they face incredibly racist stereotypes, the exotic submissive Asian women. A lot of what we have seen in our crisis work, and I'm sure you can imagine as being the case, is women who come here often don't speak the language, and that is a feature that often pimps will use in advertising Asian women, and they'll brag about how the women that they are selling don't know English, or they're new to the country, or they're fresh off the boat. So that's often a selling feature. Precarious immigration status is another factor. So the whole phenomenon of mail order brides. In Canada, we have a legal mechanism called conditional permanent residency. So this was a rule that women could, or that okay that Partners could be sponsored from a different country, but only if they stayed with their sponsor for 2 years. And so we argued that this was very dangerous for women trying to leave abusive husbands, but it's also dangerous for the women trying to leave a pimp. Another feature in North America that we have are exploitative migrant worker programs. So I know that you've got them in the States, but the temporary foreign worker programs, I think they're also called guest worker programs in the States. So these are just really awful systems where people, you know, have the privilege of working in North America, but don't have very much employment rights. The employer acts somewhat as a sponsor and has an insurmountable control over that person while they're working here, and also that their work term is temporary, which we know is a lot of the case for women who are trafficked into North America. So a lot of pimps and traffickers use those mechanisms to control women that come to North America to work.
And you've been mentioning trafficking a fair amount. You've used that word, and you know, on the organization's website, it says that globally, women constitute 85% of the victims of trafficking for sexual exploitation, and globally, 79% of reported trafficking human beings is for sexual exploitation. And can you, first off, what does it mean for a woman to be trafficked? What is the definition you use? And second, if a woman is trafficked in Canada, and your organization or someone else wants to help this person, what can be done, and what are the woman's options having been trafficked in Canada?
First of all, our organization, primarily we're an advocacy group, so we're more on the public education side, although many of us have done or still do frontline work at our various agencies. But I mean, what I would say is the cornerstone of trafficking is coercion is a huge part of it, but recruitment and transportation of people for the purposes of exploitation. And so the connection I make between that and prostitution is that trafficking is meant to be used as a tool for the purposes of sexual exploitation, that is prostitution. And it's used as a way to isolate women. So in Canada, we have domestic trafficking, particularly of Aboriginal women and girls. Trafficking doesn't have to happen across borders. It can happen domestically as well. But what the traffickers do is they use the transportation and isolation of women and girls to take them away from support systems that they would otherwise have to avoid recruitment to the sex industry. And in the case of global trafficking, it's much the same thing. I think, a lot of traffickers understand that women and girls are impoverished. They have very few options already, where they are, or they take advantage of poor economic circumstances, poor social circumstances, and trafficking is the way that they isolate and recruit women for profit.
When whether they are trafficked internationally or locally, what can, and recognizing you're an advocacy group specifically, but what what are women's options once, if they are trafficked to a place away from a social system, mm-hmm. what are their options with help? At that point, I mean, they've been put into this terrible situation, and how do they get out? How do they get out?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we have been arguing is that, so one of the challenges that women face when, you know, particularly in the case of, say, Asian women who are trafficked for the purposes of prostitution to Canada, many of the women are on student visas, that sort of thing. And, you know, they might get, they get trafficked here, whether they know about what they're going to do or they don't know what they're going to do. But they often, sometimes the pimp will have their travel documents, so they'll hold those hostage. But one of the challenges is that they don't want to be deported. And so one of the things we've argued for is landed status for women, in recognition of the fact that granting women landed status would undermine the power of traffickers and of men to keep and recruit women and keep them in abusive situations. In terms of Canadian law, we have some resources for trafficking, but many of the resources have been cut. I know that rape crisis centers and feminist rape crisis centers offer assistance and legal assistance to women who have been trafficked. Rape crisis centers will do that work. Transition houses will do that work. So women can go there, but it's very difficult. Canada actually has very good anti-trafficking laws, but it's a matter of enforcing those laws and doing so in a way that doesn't threaten the status of the women reporting trafficking, but also not requiring the testimony of the women being trafficked.
I didn't understand the last sentence. Not requiring the testimony of the.
Right. I should be more specific. So. I know that there are some places for example, I think in New York it's a woman doesn't have to, in Canada, in order to prove that you were trafficked, you have to prove not only that you were coerced and transported somehow, but also that you feared for your life. And that's actually not required in the international definition of trafficking in persons. And it's a huge bit of a weakness in Canadian law, but I think the legal system has to find some way to hold traffickers accountable without women who have been trafficked to have to prove that they feared for their lives. But I also think that they have to work on how they're going to prosecute traffickers without having to require women to come forward, you know, in recognizing that women are already have already been exploited, and, you know, to some degree just want to move on. There's plenty of evidence that they can use in terms of the advertisements, if they followed the money, If they, you know, I think there's plenty of other avenues for evidence that they can use in terms of, you know, criminalizing traffickers and criminalizing the pimps. Was that clear?
Yeah. Thank you for that. And when you're talking about that, it's reminding me of what happens so often, not necessarily in trafficking cases, but in regular rape cases where the woman comes forward and then she is essentially crucified by the defense attorney. That's sort of what I was thinking about with that. And the defense attorney will say, oh, she really wanted this, or she participated willingly. And I'm presuming that the traffickers, that oftentimes if a woman were to come forward against a trafficker, A, she would face that, and B, she would also face the physical and perhaps terminal intimidation of the traffickers who would do anything to silence her.
Right. So, I mean, you know, not only, you know, in rape cases, not only is the tendency that women are put on trial, not the men, and the women's credibility is put on trial. And, you know, you have a whole host of problems. We had a very recent case, the Gian Gomeshi case in Canada, where he was a very famous broadcaster in Canada and basically was acquitted of all counts of sexual assault of these women, and there were multiple failures, you know, in that case in terms of what the judge believed, the immense rape culture in the beliefs of the judge, in the tactics of the defense lawyer for Gian Gomeshi, Marie Hennin, absolutely atrocious. Her tactics for how she had addressed the women and how she had tried to discredit the women. But you know, in the case of trafficking, what the women also have at stake is deportation, especially for women who want to stay in Canada. So you have immigration status hanging over women's heads in that way, right? And then not only that, but a lot of the women can't speak English. So they already have a harder time expressing themselves and explaining what exactly happened in court, and then of course this is contingent on there being, the proper supports. Does she have access to an independent women's group that is going to side with her and is going to that has her rights as their main priority? Those are all factors.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple questions. One of them is, and this is a huge and even more loaded question than the ones at the beginning, but you just mentioned rape culture. So can you try to sort of coalesce the relationships between sexualized racism, prostitution, as an institution, and rape culture? Can you make those connections really explicit explicit's the wrong word. Make those connections as clear as you can for the listeners. What role does prostitution and sexualized racism, what roles do those play in the larger rape culture that characterizes this patriarchal system?
I think prostitution very much has to do with the ability to undermine a woman's consent to sex. It's an industry based on undermining women's consent, and I think that's very attached to rape culture in the sense of male entitlement to to women's bodies and to and to sexual access to a woman. I mean, here, I mean, I'll give you an example. I live in Montreal, and I'm a student at McGill. I see a huge I see huge rape culture on campus. You have rape chants at Frosch. Our football teams, we have our football team's behavior in 2012, where there were three men that had sexually assaulted a woman or a few women. At the same time, the school has the largest number of sugar babies, which are younger women, usually students, that are sought out by older men for prostitution. And, you know, a lot of women don't call it that, but that's what it is. So it will be older men that it's expected that they will pay for for their dates, possibly help women pay for tuition. But it's that taking advantage of women's social, political, and economic insecurity and inequality. And using that to gain control and sexual access over women. And I think rape culture plays into that in those ways. Like they sort of support each other. I hope that was somewhat coherent. Like the example.
Yeah. No, that was a great articulation.
I mean, it's a direct consequence, right, of systemic patriarchy, of male supremacy. It's the root cause of women's inequality, and we contend with it in our everyday lives. And it really, I think it touches like all of our lives as women over, the danger of rape, of being recruited into the sex industry, wife battery, of incest, all of these ways in which men can gain sexual access to women and to girls, throughout our lifetimes. And I think we have to start making these connections to how that relates to women's inequality relative to men, and how we can get some women's liberation, how we can achieve that.
So thank you for that. And the last question is, so how can anybody listening to this interview who would like to either A, help your organization, Asian Women Coalition Ending Prostitution, mm-hmm. or would like to otherwise join the larger struggle against men's oppression of women, and specifically against trafficking of women, and specifically trafficking of women of color and Asian mm-hmm. women, what can an individual who lives in Nova Scotia or who lives in South Dakota or Texas, what can they do to either help your organization or to otherwise join the larger struggle?
Okay, well, I mean, on a very direct level, you can, keep in touch with us, the Asian Women Coalition Ending Prostitution. We have a Facebook group. We have a website. It's awcep.org. But I would say more broadly, specifically to prostitution, I think you can support the abolition of prostitution, as one of those key components for advancing women's equality and liberation. So what that means is, it's a legal tactic of decriminalizing the women in recognition that they shouldn't be punished. We shouldn't be punished for our poverty, but to criminalize both the pimps and the buyers for exploiting women. It also includes a public education campaign related to educating the population about violence against women and how prostitution is a form of violence against women. But it also has to include strengthening the social welfare system. So providing those exit services and prevention strategies, universal childcare, education, supporting the call for a guaranteed livable income that would do a lot to address women's economic insecurity. Now, more broadly, I think for listeners, I would say support the independent women's movement. We're not, not merely as a subset of the left, but as the women's liberation movement, and take her leadership, support funding to anti-violence feminist groups, but within men, I think holding other men accountable is really important. Stop using pornography. Stop using prostitution. Those two practices are hugely contribute to the inequality between men and women. Stop rape. I think those are male behaviors that really need to be addressed. Women have been talking about for many years now, and men have to change. I think Andrea Dworkin, said it in the 80s, in her, I want a 24-hour truce during which there is no rape. So I think those are the key messages I would want to communicate.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Sarah Ma. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.